Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And today we have again joining our program from last week is Alex J. Signeri. He's joining us from a radio talk show that he comes on daily there in Chicago. And Alex, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the Socialist Insight. Thanks again.
Oh, no, again, always thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure talking with you, Stuart, and always interested to talk about the conversation you want to talk about.
And as we mentioned, this is a Socialist Insight. One of the things that you bring to the table when you join the program, Alex, you bring about a broad perspective, insight into many of the issues that are facing working people, and insight to many of the issues that we look at every day from a left perspective, and we really appreciate that. Today, we were supposed to have Alan Mackey joining the program. We have Alan on as a regular guest with the program, but unfortunately, he has some other commitments that he had to deal with today. So we will be having him on some of our future broadcasts. But today on our program, what we're talking about is grassroots organizing for revolutionary change. Grassroots organizing for revolutionary change. And I think the people, the real left, we're looking for revolutionary changes. We're not looking for reforms. If you want reforms, then you can go to the libertarians. If you want reforms, you can go to the Greens. If you want reforms, you can go and talk about many of the things that are being presented by the Democrats. They talk about reforms. But we're not talking about reforming capitalism, because any kind of reforms that you talk about, basically what you're doing, you're talking about trying to reform capitalism, because most of the politics that you see on the right and the center, that's geared toward moving capitalism forward here in the U.S. We believe on the left that capitalism is not right for working class people. So today we're going to be discussing some things with a program that was just recently organized by Alex Signeri, and also we're going to talk a little bit about a program with that Alan has been involved in. But first we're going to start out with this program, the Foundation for a United Front. And recently, Alex, you asked me to come and get involved in this organization. But what I want you to do is take just a couple of minutes and tell us, what is the Foundation for a United Front?
Well, Stuart, the Foundation United Front is an organization that has three components to it. The first component being to network with organizations and try to come and advance issues on common ground things, and also try to get other organizations to break down their own silos in order to advance those issues. The second component is education training. We do a lot of programs. In fact, this past Saturday we had our third annual Stonewall Riot panel, where we brought in a lot of LGBT activists and people within the community to talk about issues within the LGBT community since Stonewall. And then the final component is we're trying to figure out some sort of financial assistance, that be it grants or scholarships, for grassroots organizations in order for them to successfully move forward with the work that they're doing.
So those are the three main components. Now, one of the things you mentioned first, you say network organizations. Now, we see a lot of groups out there trying to network organizations. I was a member of the Peace and Freedom Party well over 15 years. We see the Socialist Party, Peace and Freedom Party, what they were involved in was networking groups on the left. And basically, through that organization, what they do is it's a multi-tendency party. In other words, you may be maybe of some of a socialist organization or socialist organization or communist or whatever left groups that you're involved in, but as a multi-tendency organization, they drew people from many areas of the left. Same thing with the Socialist Party USA, which you and I both are members of. So when you say network organizations, how is the United Foundation for a United Front, how does it differ from those organizations that are multi-tendency that are bringing other groups, organizations, individuals together under one umbrella? How are you different?
Well, we're different because we're multi-ideological. So, I mean, we work with socialists, we work with Greens, we work with even libertarians and certain conservatives who even feel that we all can come down to ground issues. For example, net neutrality. You can talk to anybody and across the board, everyone agrees net neutrality is an issue that everyone agrees on. And there's different capacities that people look at it, but, you know, we can combat it in different ways, just like ballot access. You know, if we just work with third parties, you know, whether you're libertarian, constitution, socialist, green, whatever, you know, even ballot access, even on the left, is in parts of the right. That's a common ground issue, and we can strive towards and trying to get ballot access a little bit more equal in states like Virginia, Illinois, Georgia, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, in order to combat the injustices that are going on when it comes to ballot access. So that's what I mean by that, because every organization that you can think of, they put up silos, and by that I mean they only work in an insular fashion, and that's why there's membership is going down, fundraising doesn't go as great as they hope to, advancing their own issues and just want to focus on, you know, come on our side and our side only. We're saying, no, let's co-work together, let's be collaborative and be creative on how to address these issues.
Okay, I'm curious. You say break down the silos and identify the barriers. When I was running as a presidential candidate in 2012, I approached the Greens to be on their ballot. I didn't even indicate that, you know, I was running as a socialist. The only thing is I wanted to run on the Green Party ballot in many of the states that they were, that they would be and were on the ballot. The only barrier they saw was, I mean, they saw it was my name and my request to be on the ballot, but many of them already knew that I was a socialist, and their contact with me, Alex, was I would need to end or terminate my membership with the Socialist Party USA. Remember, I identified myself as a candidate. I had to terminate my relationship with the Socialist Party USA, become a member of the Greens, just so I could enter the race with the Green Party. Now, when we're talking about breaking down barriers, when you're just trying to affiliate with an organization based right. on finding some common ground, and then they have their prejudices in regards to just the name or your affiliations, how does that come into, how does that work within your organization? Because obviously people are going to want to come and get involved and join, and they may say, Howie Hawkins, oh he's a Green. And all of a sudden, there's a barrier. You know, Cindy Sheehan, she's with a socialist organization. She's with many right. organizations. How do you break down those barriers just when people know what your previous affiliations were?
Right, right. So let me just start by saying that what you're talking about, Stuart, is more about political parties, all right? And I understand what your line of questioning is, but let me put it in a little bit more better context, and that is this. There's an organization in Chicago that deals with better health care for prisons, police accountability, things of that nature. They're called the Chicago Alliance Against Race and Political Repression. I'm on the organizing committee. But their job as an organization, they feel, is you come on board with us and solely us in order to advance our movement. And that's the key word, our movement.
In our movement. And I noticed you said solely.
Yes. And it's the same thing with the Unitarian Universal Association, the National Unitarian Church. They even say our movement. That means they're working insular within their organization. And that's what I'm really talking about. And we're breaking those kinds of barriers down because, yes, Chicago Alliance Against Race and Political Repression, yeah, I understand where you're coming from, but Stop Mass Incarceration is doing the same work you're doing. And a few others that deal with mass incarceration, stop and frisk, healthcare in prisons, police accountability. There's many of those across the U.S., right? So one project that we're trying to do is a prison justice assembly here in Chicago to bring all those kinds of groups together, conduct workshops, listen to what other people are doing, listen to speakers on what the work they're also doing, and then maybe somehow bring coalitions together to communicate all of those issues as one big solidified movement rather than your own little islands, you know? Because that, at the end of the day, is not going to work for your organization. Now, going to political parties, it is the same way. But again, the difference is they're in the business of politics, so there is a degree that I understand that, you know, if you're going to run as a socialist, it better be just socialist candidates and not be an officer of Socialist Worker Party or whatever, right? But but also, they too ought to break down their barriers because even – and this is one of my criticisms with the Green Party is we are so insular. We're not working. We're not organizing with environmental groups, with – you know, feminist groups, or anything. We're talking about running candidates, and we can't just run candidates, even though we're in the business of politics. We can't run candidates because when was the last time deep systemic change came out of politics?
Right.
And I'm still waiting for an answer on that, you know?
Right. And what I'm looking at, when I look at, when you say a foundation for United Front, I'm assuming it's a political organization. Is it not?
No, it's an apolitical organization, and that's also the key thing. You know, we have – when it got founded, it was pretty much – the early foundations, if you will, no pun intended, it was in 2006 when I just got doing a consulting practice on my own. And then around 2009, I made that into a nonprofit organization. And then from there, I brought in – most of my radical friends on board as board directors and trying to get something on the ground and something moving. We did, that's when I was living in Springfield, Illinois. We did a lot of panels, we did a lot of teach-ins, and we used the teach-ins of the Occupy method of teach-ins and everything. So it was really got started by all of us radical younger people to get this thing going and everything, and now trying to move even more forward.
So it's been around it's been around for 8 years?
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a little bit more underground than, you know, out in the mainstream, if you will. So, I mean, but little by little, most of our programs have been known. Some of us know the kind of work that we do. It's just now we are in the revamp mode and trying to make the Foundation at Front a little bit more bigger and badder organization in order for us to do the real kind of work we want to do.
Now, when I look at the organization, who presently, do you have any individuals that you may mention that have endorsed the manifesto, the platform organization?
Well, we have like Gay Liberation Network has supported us over the years out of here out of Chicago. We have certain individual socialists and greens and I will say anarchists who have supported what we're doing. Even certain libertarians have supported what we're doing as well, because they also feel that even though they may disagree on some of the things that we're doing, but they agree that an organization like this is needed and everything. Because back in 2012, we did a women's panel. You know, we had this women's panel, and we'd probably bring left and the right spectrum to this panel and everything, Planned Parenthood and Right for Life, to come and talk about why are we having these kinds of issues on both right and left and everything. So that's even more so why certain people all across the spectrum like us, because we don't berate people with politics or political philosophy. It's more conversation, because I think, you know, as I said on even on my radio show, Stuart, is like, I want more conversation, more civil discourse in order to understand what's going on, because I think that's what's really lost, is those kinds of things. And if we continue to do those kinds of things, I think we could be much better at moving the kind of issues we want to move forward if everybody understands where we're all coming from, rather than just...
Now, I noticed there was a slight chuckle when you mentioned about anarchists, bringing them on board. How, if you're an anarchist, how with, because most anarchists, when you start looking at the structure of what I see here, they probably wouldn't fit in too well. But, I mean, am I right or am I wrong? I mean,
That's the thing. It's like I was a little bit more worried about, you know, the structure and everything. But if you look at certain anarchist organizations and certain anarchist philosophy, some of them adhere to the kind of structure of the organization that I have. It's a little bit more of a cooperative, worker cooperative base structure that I have right now. And there's some anarcho-syndicalists, and there's probably certain anarcho-primitivists, the more green anarchists, who are probably a little bit more in tune to that kind of thing versus your anarcho-capitalist, which that's just an oxymoron in itself.
I noticed you say the foundation for the United Front is an organization that believes in what Saul Alinsky defines as community as something not a physical like municipalities and religions, but where identity groups and issue organizations create a community. Explain just a little bit about, you know, Saul Alinsky and this philosophy that you adhere to in the founding of this organization.
Well, Saul Alinsky said that in around 1940, where when he was starting doing community organizing, the very fundamentals that he was trying to construct, he viewed community as not physical. So like in Chicago, he's not talking about the community of the city of Chicago. He's talking about like the black community, the Latino community, the LGBT community, the youth community, because that is a little bit more broad and a little bit more spread out than just, you know, the physical political boundary of a community. Because once we say things like the black community of Chicago, then we specifically know what areas what we're talking about and the issues are going to arise when we say something like that, versus when we say, like, you know, the environmental community. Well, that's even more broader, and that's even more specific areas around the city and everything also. So, I mean, that's what I mean by community, and that's what the foundation also strives for, is when we talk about community, we're talking about the women community, the youth community, those kinds of things. And that's what we want to uphold more, is that versus saying, oh, it's just, you know, Glenview, the suburb of Chicago, or Ottawa, Illinois, all the way out in downstate Illinois, things like that. No, we're talking a little bit more spread out, a little bit more broad in order to help advance the issues within those communities.
I'm reading from Wikipedia. Say, in the course of nearly four decades of political organizing, Alinsky received much criticism but also gained praise from many public figures. His organizing skills were focused on improving the living conditions of poor communities across North America. In the 1950s, he began turning his attention to improving conditions in the African-American ghettos, beginning with Chicago and later traveling to other ghettos in California, Michigan, New York, New York City, and dozens of other troubled spots. Now, when I look at this, and one of the things that I like to focus on is he often noted for his book, Rules for Radicals. Now, I noticed many things. I lived in Los Angeles in the 1950s, and I saw that most of the blacks were just, they were confined to just the Watts area. You knew that you didn't go on the other side of Broadway because you start going into the white communities such as Inglewood, toward Torrance and Hawthorne, and being in those areas at night, that was surely you're going to be stopped by a police officer, probably cited by something, and told to go back to your part of town. So I noticed much of the organizing that was done in the black communities, but when you saw the real radical change, Alex, it took place when the Black Panthers hit the streets, we right. started seeing change. When you saw the riots in Los Angeles, all of a sudden they said, you know, change was coming, you know. And most of the change that you have seen in the course, the real change in this country has been because of the radical change that has taken place. And then when you start relying on the Democrats and various social change to go through the system, all of a sudden you see change has grind down to a halt. You see more blacks going to the unemployment lines than anyone else. The prison population for blacks and Hispanics are growing at a rapid pace. But when I look at for radical change, and I'm looking at various organizations out there, whether it's political or non-political, when I see the rules for radical change and I see Alinsky, what he was talking about, seemed like we have deviated from radical change rather than trying to have some type of gradual social change, which I don't know if it even works in today's society. Because most of the time, Alex, what happened is those groups or organizations, they either become assimilated into the Democratic Party, or they become assimilated into, like, the Greens, or they become assimilated, like years ago, the Democrats, you know, they assimilated the NAACP, and all of a sudden, if it was anything, you know, that was contrary to the doctrines of the Democratic Party, all of a sudden, like, whoa, you need to slow down, you see. So are we talking, when you say the foundation for a united front, are we talking about radical change, or what are we talking about?
No, it's more radical change than, dare I say, progressive change, because there needs to be a real radical change in our society. There really needs to be. And no one talks about, like, the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Just like this past Saturday at our third annual Stonewall Riot panel, who else is talking about LGBT issues? Who's talking about transgender issues? And when I say talk about it, I mean, like, talk about the intersectionality of the LGBT community and the religious community. Who's actually talking about, you know, when we talk about equal marriage bill here in Illinois, and they never address about immigration at all in order for immigrants to stay in Illinois, you know, no one's talking about that. So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that we do, and when we get on our feet a little bit more and actually do a little bit more direct actions, then we'll hopefully get people to listen, not listen to us, but at least come to our table and co-work with us and collaborate on how to address the issues and then possibly, you know, get legislation passed.
And one of the things when I talk about radical change, because, you know, sometimes, Alex, today I'm thinking that's not just today, but I really think that's the only way that we're going to succeed is with radical change. And that's what we saw during the Occupy movement. We saw radical change. We saw people hitting the streets. Oh, you should have seen in Oakland. I mean, they were on fire, and the city was on fire there in Oakland. And
right.
over across the nation, when they saw that it was this fervor, you know, calling for change, and sometimes I couldn't identify what the change was, but I could see it was people out in the streets saying they were fed up with the system and fed up with the changes that were being brought down from Washington, D.C., again, we saw where they start going in trying to assimilate the radical movement of the Occupy participants. And when they couldn't assimilate them, then they sent in the police, and they sent in the guards, and they sent in the dogs, and came in with the fire hoses and all of this, and the spray mace or whatever it was. And then they start arresting them and putting them in jail. So when you talk about real change, as long as it's not a threat, Alex, and this is what we see in this country, as long as it's not a threat, it's okay to mosey on. As long as it's not non-threatening, but you're making some type of movement, then you have people from the center come and move in, and all of a sudden, and I might say that I believe that that is the function of the Democratic Party, is to become like a vacuum for the real left, because we only have two political parties in this country. But
yeah.
any type of social movement or social change that take place, and when I say social change, that's what you're advocating here with the Foundation for a United Front. As long as you're not doing anything as long as you're non-threatening, you know, they allow you to mosey on. So my question is this organization, how are they going to be able to create real change and have people involved that's going to advocate for that real change? How is that going to be accomplished? Because that's what we need today. We need leadership. And right now, Alex, on the left, we really don't have no leadership. I mean,
no, you're right.
Do you see it? I don't.
No, I mean, there's leadership on the left, but unfortunately, when you're walking through the fog, you have to make sure you have the right signals to make sure they're the right leaders or not. But
right.
to your question, I'm a huge fan of models. And when I say that, I mean, I like to look at what other social movements have done in the past and what individuals have done in the past and currently also, and try to look at those and then how does that fit into the work that I'm doing with the Foundation for United Front. So I look at things of what Occupy did and look at the criticisms too. I also look at Socialist Party America when SPUSA was SPA. I also look at what the original IWW has done. I also look at even parts of the progressive era, what happened there and what didn't
right.
work and how people got more of a pulse of society than others. And that's how I feel that's how the Foundation is going to do it, is try to understand what was done in the past and then try to formulate that now to create a better future. Because what I really feel is lost is that people really don't learn from the past.
Oh, they don't.
And
I agree 100% on that.
You know, I mean, anytime I talk about, like, well, even Bill William Buckley, you know.
William Buckley? Mm-hmm.
Because everyone looks at me, why him? I'm like, why not him? From the 50s to the 80s, that's how the conservatives got into play. So I learned from the playbook of what William Buckley did in order to do what we need to do in the left. Why not learn from thy enemy?
I'm just going to take a short pause here just to mention once again that we first I'd like to thank our listeners for joining the Socialist Insight once again. Today we have Alex J. Signeri. He's joining our program today, and we're discussing grassroots organizing for revolutionary change. And Alex, I might mention that Alex is with a, he's a regular talk show host there in Chicago. The program is called Out Front. And Alex, could you just share a little bit about what Out Front is about and what have you been talking about this this past week?
Well, this week has been a little slow. So, I mean, we've been mostly been bashing the right a little bit from...
Oh, good. Good job.
From the, you know, there's no such thing as climate change to their war on women still to why John Boehner is suing Barack Obama, you know, so it's just been that, and I, not profusely, I kind of apologize to my listeners because I like to make my show a little bit more balanced, you know, bash from the left and the right, but the left, when I say the left, I mean Democrats, they haven't done anything just yet in order for me to be like, oh, shame on you for doing this.
Right. When it comes right in your neighborhood, we're looking at something that is very menacing, the construction of the Keystone XL project. What is going on, and what is going on with that, and what discussions are you having on your program in regards to that? That's an issue that I've been following over the years.
I gotta be honest. I mean, we don't talk about that as much as like I should and everything because I'll allow our other host, Dr. Laura Chamberlain. She has a show called All In from Mother Earth, where she deals with that more than I. So I just let her have all those kinds of things. But what I do talk about from time to time regarding XL Pipeline is people like, can't think of his last name. He's on MSNBC, Ed. Wow, can't think of it.
You got me.
Well, he's on MSNBC.
And what is was he saying?
He was originally he talked about you know shame on XL Pipeline and everything else, and then on a show he did a whole 180 degrees and saying, you know what, I'm all for this. It brings in business. It does this. It does that. I'm like, you totally dropped your entire platform to say you were all against it, and now you're all for it because of jobs, and you cannot say with your platform that we need more public banks, we actually need to have a higher minimum wage, that we need to keep business accountable, but you're here to say keep on the XL pipeline so that we can have jobs. And not to mention, you know, we're going to damage the environment when we certain have spills or something goes wrong, you know?
Well, we really do appreciate your program and what you your contributions to the community. And we're going to just pick up where we left off a few minutes ago with the program. I still want to cover some areas with the new Progressive Alliance. The main difference I can see is the new Progressive Alliance leans a little bit more toward organizing on the political left as opposed to your organization. It's the principles and organization is a little bit, not a little bit, is significantly different. And you had mentioned also in the Foundation for the United Front Manifesto, these principles will not come to life on their own. People and organizations are needed to make the foundation open and participatory, people acting as individuals working together in groups and leading others. The organization is committed to advancing the principles set out in the manifesto. We invite others to join us and make the Internet an ever better place for everyone. Now, I'm looking at these principles. You start out education and training is a key component to better understand issues and praxis. Could you explain what that is, the role of this organization in regards to your first identifying your first principle?
Well, in order to understand issues, we have to educate and train both the public and activists, because when you have groups like US PIRG or was it 9 to 5, Wisconsin, 15 now. It is great to have organizers and give them the talking points and, as you said, assimilate to their own organizing method, right? That's all great, but what do they really know? Do they really know the entire context to fighting for $15 an hour? Do they know that, you know, it's great to have 15, but we ought to fight for 21 because that 21 will put us more of at a liberal wage than 15? Prime example, I was right here in my town of Evanston, and Greenpeace was right outside Panera and everything. They came up with a clipboard saying, "You want to, we're doing our membership drive, you want to be a member?" And I go, "No, I do not." And he further and said, "Well, why not?" I'm like, "I don't adhere to your militant methods when addressing environmental issues." And he looked at me, kind of like, gave me like this little snarky look. He says, "Well, you have a nice day." And I stopped him. It's like, no, you can't do that. You can't say have a nice day, because do you even know what I mean? Why even go and be very militant on other shifts to destroy stuff? That's not a good method. If we had a conversation about it, he goes, "Well, I guess I didn't really know about that." And I go, "That's what I'm talking about. We need to learn both as activists as well as the public on these issues, and once we all understand this, then, yeah, we can pass on that leadership to others, and that's where you can get this autonomous leadership and move and pass it forward, if you will, when it comes to education."
Now, the foundation will be a collaborative organization by conducting a co-working practice.
Yeah. So essentially, as I said before, you know, we need to work together. We need to collaborate. Right now, us in the creative space I work out of here in Chicago called Multiculti, and there's another organization called Civic Lab, we're the only three in the Chicago area, actually the Chicago area, including the suburbs, that does this. You know, we actually ask people to come and hang out and work together, collaborate. Where I work out of at a Multiculti, we have a big whiteboard, and we use that to plan certain projects, and we have a green screen room that we can do various commercials. We have the radio that we can use from time to time and everything. No other organizations do that. No other organizations bring in other organizations on board and saying, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" You know, they may have organizing committees where they ask those organizations to say, "Hey, do you buy into what we're doing? Good? Okay, now listen to us." We're not saying that. We're not, you know, the teacher telling the class. We are part of the class. You know, we are saying we're not the head. We are part of this collaborative movement together.
Right. Well, one of the things I'm looking at when I say a collaborative organization conducting working practices, back in 2006, I was working with the Peace and Freedom Party, and one of the things is I had introduced to them was creating a national organizing committee where they would, outside of politics, just deal with many of the issues that the party dealt with, whether it was on international affairs, whether it was education, whether it was on working class issues. And we had sent out, the organization had sent out information to 100-plus organizations and leaders on the left. And during our first meeting that we had of the National Organizing Committee with that organization, out of the 100-plus organizations and leaders in the national community that we had sent information inviting them to this conference, it was less than five people that, whether they were representing an organization or themselves, that even showed up. And you're saying the foundation will be a collaborative organization, bringing, you know, where you can co-work together, How is that being done? How is it being received?
Well, another prime example would be, when was back in March, the Gay Liberation Network reached out to me and saying they're going to have this planning meeting to have a protest outside of the Illinois Holocaust Museum's humanitarian awards dinner because they were going to honor Dr. Henry Kissinger as a humanitarian.
Okay.
You laugh and you know
right.
why.
Yeah.
So because of the Gay Liberation Network, they brought us to the table. We also brought in some other people from like World Can't Wait. We had one person that we work with the International Socialist Organization and a few other organizations to come to this planning meeting, and we all dropped our ideologies and saying, okay, who's going to handle media? Who can reach out to this person? Who can reach out to this organization? And within, I think it was like 3 weeks or four, about 3 weeks, we pulled off a great protest. There was about 50 people who showed up. We had the media there. We actually got a statement of solidarity from the School of the Americas Watch organization. So it was great. It was awesome, and we also had a lot of people understanding what we were doing, and it was not like one organization who was doing the lead. It was many of us working together and utilizing our talents and resources in order to pull something that was very short notice.
The third one you have here, it says that working together on common issues will cultivate diversity and experience.
Yeah. You need diversity when talking about issues. We can't just have the same people who come to the same organization and have like this monoculture when addressing issues. We need diversity. We need people who can speak to both mainstream media and alternative media. We need people who can do the crowdfunding and people who can hit the what's the word I'm looking for? High donors and what have you. Those
right.
are the things that we need. We need to cultivate that kind of diversity in order to advance issues. Because any organization, any not-for-profit journal that you read, any studies, anyone who's doing an MBA regarding not-for-profit, they will tell you that the reason why there's low turnout with volunteers, why there's no fundraising, and why budgets are very small is because they just stick to themselves and not branch out and get others involved. They're only engaged.
How many blacks or Hispanics are involved in the organization?
Right now, we have three black men, and we have one Latino.
Okay, that's good. I was, I can speak regarding my involvement with the Peace and Freedom Party since 1998. I'm no longer affiliated with the organization, but the organization at the meetings from time to time, it could range anywhere from 15 to as many as over 45 people that would attend the meetings. And most of the time, either I was the only black or one of two blacks even attending the meeting. Generally, you will find Hispanics that would be participating. It would probably, again, be somewhere between one to maybe three. And I like what I see here when you say cultivate diversity and experience, because in each group, many of us, I mean, we can relate to the same issues when it comes to jobs, when it comes to education. All the issues are, we can identify no matter what race, what color you are. So that's good that you have that. About how many people did you say are currently actively involved in the organization? Actively?
Yeah. Well, right now we have a core of about 10 people. And
okay, so one-third. One-third. What was that again?
And they're spread out throughout the country.
Okay. And you can count my involvement. You have sent me information about getting involved in, and I guess you already, you know, I haven't gotten back with you on that, but you do have my commitment on that. We have a transparent community-based processes promote participation, accountability, and trust. Did I say that right? Transparent community-based processes promote, to promote participation, accountability, and trust. What is that?
Yeah. Well, just that basic transparency when it comes to communication. There's a lot of organizations
you mean
that work
communicating the organization, is that correct?
Yeah. What's
going on in the organization?
I mean, there's like organizations I've worked with where there's no transparency. It's like, well, the board said this, and what they say. You don't need to
right.
know. Our steering committee will handle that. No, I'm paying a membership. I need to know. You know.
Right.
So I mean, just that transparency, that basic, fundamental thing that every organization, whether you're a Fortune 500 company, or you're just two guys working on a food truck, you need that kind of transparency.
And that's a good thing, because most, whether it's an organization or politics or whatever, we see more and more in this country, you know, you never, when you look at the hierarchy, there's no transparency. It's, you know, whatever comes down the pipe, the person at the bottom of the pipe, you know, they're expected just to do whatever is being told them. But transparency is something that we need in more organizations, whether it's political or social organizations. And we are lacking that. The fifth one you have on the list is magnify those ignored, marginalized, misrepresented, unrepresented topics and issues by bringing people together to discuss freely our societal problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said before, we had our panel event this past Saturday, and we were addressing issues that no one in the media is addressing, no one like from other quote-unquote grassroots organizations are addressing, politicians are addressing. We're the ones that are addressing it. We're addressing that, yeah, there's conservative religious groups that don't like the LGBT community, but there's others who do. And no one's addressing that. No one's addressing that. There are churches out there who for years have been behind the LGBT community, and no one's reaching out to that. No one's even addressing about how businesses are not even safe for transgender people. They can't even go to a restroom, for crying out loud, because they either have to pick one or the other of their quote-unquote actual sexuality, you know? I mean,
right.
no one's addressing that at all, but we are. It's just like, you know, no one's addressing the housing situation in Chicago as much, and that's why we have the almost dismantling of the black community in Chicago. Who's really talking about that?
Now, when I look at these issues, hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting a feedback on the line here. When I look at, you know, you say magnify those ignored, marginalized, misrepresented, underrepresented, and topics, unrepresented topics. When I look at that, magnify those ignored, marginalized, and I think about what is going on there just next door to you there in Detroit. How does an organization like this, speaking out with how the water is being turned out to, you know, thousands of people across that city because of non-payment, is this something that would be relevant to this organization speaking out on an issue such as that, the foundation of the United Front, speaking out against issues that are affecting an entire community?
Well, of course. I mean, if we had a bigger operating budget and a little bit more organizers, you know, we would probably do a little bit more performative direct actions to show, like, if we get businesses and restaurants involved to shut their water off, and people panicking because they can't go to Starbucks to get coffee because you need water for coffee. You know, you can't go to a restroom because you need water to go to a restroom, you know. So
right.
I mean, if we did something like that and people really understand what Troy's going through, that would be like an aha moment. There's one it was a project someone did. I think it was
South Africa,
where it was like this guy who played a drum set in the middle of the night, and everyone called the police. They knocked on his door saying, "Can you please be quiet?" The next night, he played on his laptop. A guy essentially beating a woman. No one called the police. No one came knocking on the door because he wanted to really address that. When are we going to address that problem, that we are allowing closed doors of people beating other people?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, so, I mean, to answer your question, yeah. I mean, something like what's going on in Troy, we would be on board with that if we would have, again, be a little more bigger and badder in order to be in solidarity, well, not solidarity, in order to address the issues, but it'd be in solidarity with the activists to get the water back on to make Detroit not being ruined as it's currently going right now.
Right. And, you know, when I see this country where they're spending billions of dollars, you just allocated $500 billion to go and $500 million to go and increase our involvement and participation in that war in Iraq, something that we caused from the very beginning. And, you know, monies that are going out, and then here the federal government refuse to turn and look back and take care of the people here in this country. You know, not only the taxpayers, but people that live here, that were born here, that have been part of the labor force here in this country, and allow their water to be turned off. I mean, I'm surprised that this hasn't been met with outrage across the nation. I mean, you see it on Facebook, and I don't know if Facebook is just something just to appease us, so like, well, at least people are talking about it. But really, people need to be out in the street on this with signs and say, you know, we're not going to tolerate this. But we become a nation that we're, you know, we have become just followers. And there's no leaders nowhere. Everyone is following these two political parties that is taking us down a pathway of destruction. And what is happening to those people in Detroit, this is the destiny of millions of others in this country. It's like, well, we'll just wait until it gets to our community. I mean, but it's coming.
Right.
And, you know, we need organizations like this. There's two more I want to cover. And it's empower individuals to conduct their work autonomously. Explain that, please.
Well, with our work working autonomously, you know, there's no hierarchy in the Foundation for United Front. We have two entities within the foundation. There's an advisory board, and then there's something what I call the administrative council. And the administrative council acts kind of like a board of directors, where you have, like, you know, executive or director of development, director of communications. All of them have an equal say and equal vote when it comes to policies within the foundation. Everyone's work is equal. It's not like, you know, as executive director, you know, my work is more important than director of finance. Everyone's equally important because we're all equally working towards to make this a better organization. So we do that, and then because we don't have, like, membership, people can come and go as they please with different organizations or as individuals, and they can work autonomously that way, and that's how we can work. It's almost like I said, the Occupy model. You know, that's what the one thing I liked about Occupy, where people came together and they worked autonomously. So, I mean, again, so
right.
The models that I turn to, like Occupy, to make something like the Foundation United Front a little bit more somewhat structured, but not call it Occupy.
Well, I just want to make a very brief announcement that we're going to close out and give you some closing words on the foundation and also grassroots organizing. Once again, we have Alex J. Signeri. He's joining our program today. He was on last week, and we look forward to having Alex on as a regular guest for the program. Today we're talking about grassroots organizing for revolutionary change. And Alex is with a weekly radio program there in Chicago. It's called Out Front. Could you just, in a capsule, just mention what Out Front is all about once again, Alex?
Yeah, the radio show Out Front is a Monday through Friday talk show where I essentially talk about inside politics, insider politics, insider activism, and also talk about the arts, artists, and different art movements, and essentially just, you know, address issues that no other radio personality is addressing. And we bring in various guests. We have an in-depth conversation about the work they do and topics within the work they do, and that's pretty much Out Front.
Alex, my, you know, I came, when I met you, this was sometime last year, it was through a meeting with the Socialist Party USA, and you've been involved with that organization, I believe, for around a year or so. Your involvement with the SPUSA, what do you hope to get out of an organization like that, a political organization? As I mentioned, both of us have membership in the organization. And how do you see yourself being able to contribute to a radical left organization such as SPUSA, a radical political organization such as SPUSA?
What I like about SPUSA is that electoral politics is not the forefront agenda. It's organizing. And I really feel political parties need to be more organizing than getting people on the ballot, because you put too much time, effort, and if you're a third party, legal finances to get someone on the ballot. Whereas SPUSA, you actually are talking about, you know, how are you going to end the prison industrial complex? How are you going to address the environment in a radical way? How are you going to address war like we have been for some time? And that's what I get out of it, is the organizing and trying to get a little bit more involved on the organizing efforts and everything. And in turn, I kind of hope SPUSA becomes a great political party, not because we elect people into an office, and I hope we do get more people elected into office. However, I would like for people to know, if you want change, you go to SPUSA in order to get organizing, because it's always been SPUSA, in the previous name, SPA, that has always been on the forefront on issues in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
From the 1900s till now, they always been on the forefront of the issues. It was SP where the IWW was born. It was SP that all the great people that we know, Norman Thomas, Eugene Debs, Big Bill Hayward, all those great people were either a part of or worked with SP at some time, and because of that, their legacy moved forward.
Alex, I have one more minute, and I would just like for you to do give you the last word on grassroots organizing for revolutionary change, our program today.
So, in essence, everyone needs to be involved in grassroots activism for radical change. We cannot have progressive change. We need radical change. The radical change doesn't start by getting elected in the office. Radical change by starting down the street, getting more masses together and addressing the issues to push legislation from the outside of the hollow halls of government. And I'm just going to end
with that. I really appreciate you joining our program again today. Look forward to having you to join us on a future broadcast. I just want to mention once again, next week we'll be coming to you under a new name. It'll be Turn Left with Stuart Alexander. Same time, Same programming.
It will be left turn.
Left turn with Stuart Alexander. I was just told that. Left turn with Stuart Alexander. That'll be next week. Thank you very much, Ruth Ann. Thank you, Alex. We look forward to having you to join us next week. And I was looking at it.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks, AJ. Thanks, Stuart. Bye-bye.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome to the dialogue. Hello, Mr. Ken, our facilitator.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. And Mercury goes direct today, guys. So, hey.
Hello.
Yay.
I think I felt that. I really did.
This one's been really strange, I think. I've heard people say it's been very intense. I just think it's been very different because, well, you know, Mercury retrograde anyway is what it is for communication and transportation. And then we've got this whole vibrational change that we're all going through. So I think this one was interesting.
It's a different kind of intensity. Been going through like a very, like really attacking some very old personal issues in my life, like as far as like trying to get to a little more, what would you call it, efficient functioning in day-to-day things, you know, just tapping into some very old, what would you call it, obsessive habits with how I operate, with not separating business and family life, you know, and things, and working on this. And then, you know, I just had a very large business deal come to fruition all during this time, which normally they don't, and yet it came better. Like, what's weird about this one is it's been very personal and very not on the outward, and the personal stuff, you can't blame anyone. It's just you misreacting and you mismanaging things that you manage. But what was nice was it's been really revealing. Like, I've had like an extremely, we'll call it like a lot of luck in my scenarios, you know, like I've come out on top when I shouldn't have many times with relationship stuff, and then it became really insightful, and I've had like some really massive leaps just in home relationships and stuff with my children, everybody. It's wild, you know, and technically, that doesn't happen on retrograde. That usually, you know, things fall apart. Things don't work out. And I'm looking at my bullshit's falling apart and my bullshit's not working out. So it's really different. You know, you get what I'm saying? Like, all the stuff that I've been clinging to is falling apart, and it's frustrating because that's my comfort zone. And all of a sudden, my comfort zone is getting shook, so I'm really, like, shook up, but I learned how to let go and just let things come and do what they're going to do. Like Saturday was a really big one. I ended up, normally, you know, when money's, you know, right before you get paid, kind of transition is tight. Normally, you know, I will, like, stay extremely busy in those moments because it keeps me from focusing on the dilemma at hand. So I have, like, 500 projects. And I'll hide from the family and from friends, and I just get into them, you know? And had a nice argument about that, and I tried to come up with excuses, you know, of like, and we were just taking the kids fishing and then go to the skate park. You know, my six-year-old wanted to go, and it was a big plan, and he wanted to do it, and I'm like, but we have no money. We can't do this. It cost $5. It was a really ridiculous argument. And but I was just like, no, because I want to hide in my cave and embed myself in a project that takes 16 hours and come out tomorrow, you know, it was a good fight, and I didn't win. And I went to, like, I basically spent the rest of that night before going to bed, like, really angry, because it was what I usually do in that scenario. And then I'm like, you know, and I start stepping back and looking at the perspective, and I'm just like, all right, so I'm realizing I'm a big jerk, and my comfort's falling apart, and I'm like, I'm just going to go to bed. So I went and laid down, you know, and I, like, tried to, like, not cuddle and stuff because I'm, like, trying to be pissed. It was so stupid. It was like I was seven, you know. And then I get up in the morning, and I know I spent time in my dreams, like, dealing with it and thinking on it and blah, because I get up in the morning still trying to play that game, and it didn't really pan out because she was real nice and just very much like, oh, you poor dumb ape, you know, like, just very nice. And I couldn't be angry. And so guess what happened? We went fishing, went to the skate park, and I had the best time, and I didn't think of work, nothing. It was incredible. I walked out of that going, I'm doing it again on Sunday. And I ended up with some very close friends that are really going through some very, like, heavy stuff right now. I ended up, like, they're young, and they came over and were like, can you do a tarot reading? I'm like, hell yeah. And we just talked about stuff. They've been doing this a lot more. I've, like, become a dad figure for these girls. And it ended up, I read tarot for, like, three different people, and we talked about their lives and things. Huddled in my attic, in my room, my new cave, and we huddled up there for, like, a good 4 or 5 hours. Their kids played together, hung out. It was just, like, really awesome that if I had been my normal self, I might have missed that moment, because I would have, like, said, no, I got things going on. And none of the, you know, there's nothing important going on up there except me hiding and pretending there's something important. And so retrograde shattered my world and ruined my life. And now I have to go around and remember that I just realized I don't need that stupid tool I've had my whole life. So it was kind of it flipped a coin, but did its normal routine. It was really weird. And so I'm really enjoying retrograde this time around.
Yeah, it was good. Mine
yeah.
was titled, Everything Fell Apart Perfectly. You know?
Here you go.
So I had absolutely, the things that didn't serve me were the things that disintegrated and, you know, almost like a door slamming behind you after you pass through.
Yeah.
And the actual thing that I need to do next just landed today with such clarity and perfection.
Wow.
And, you know, I have to deal with the system right now, you know, the medical system and all these different
mm-hmm.
governmental systems. And I always look for, you know, I've done that for my daughter who's disabled. I always look for my angels in the system. You know, these are the people that just, are miraculous when you find one, because they have the ability to open doors and move and
mm-hmm.
shake when pretty much the other options are no, 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 no. And that happened for me. I found that person who came into my life today just, yep, right on the turn of the retrograde, of course. And
wow.
This stuff that wasn't going to work just with no doors shut. So, you know, I was waiting for that window to open or whatever. And ta-da, you know.
I think
light coming on.
It has to
go
do
ahead.
With all of this vibrational change that we're going through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's
yeah.
the people. I think the people, the angels in the system, are those people that have that sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. This gentleman I'm going to work with is totally about people. He worked in the system. He didn't like what it did to people. And now he's 15 years doing it for people and helping them
wow.
navigate. And he landed in my lap today to help me with my next step, and it's awesome. It's really awesome.
That's very, very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
I love it. This is kind of funny. It's a great kick into the, new discussions.
I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, like, just looking at this, like, what we're looking at, like, everything's transitioning, and it seems like all the discussions we've had, we keep running into discussing the solutions, the navigation of it all. And this is what we just kind of did it on accident, you know, like, that's the navigation. You know, that's the, I have a feeling like all the old regimes, even like universal things and, you know, astrological stuff and all of this, everything's getting a new perspective. Everything is getting a new approach and a new use. We spent a lot of time in the patriarchal, you know, Mars male angle of things where everything is shove it in the hole, you know, and now it's not. It's about taking the flow of it and using it, and we're being shown this everywhere in every aspect of everything we're doing. And even in all our discussions from day one that we started this, we always end up going to the what it would be like, you know? I mean, it was probably by the second day of talking about moneyless societies where we actually like, well, how is this going to function? What do we actually, you know, what would it be like? And I had an experience today that really kind of made me think about this. Like, oh, my God, there it is. I just landed in this discussion preemptively. I have a friend that was trying to barter services. I've been using their service and have been waiting for my farm to pick up to, like, actually recompensate, and we just got there. And they're like, well, how about I allow, you know, you let my son be an intern in the farm as an environmental engineer? And I'm like, very cool, but I don't believe in free labor, not when I can do this. I want everyone, interns, anyone that comes in, they get paid. So I'm like, I can't morally make that a favor because I would do this for anybody. And I'm like, and a friend, yeah, I'm going to be like, hey, I'm come by, we'll check them out. I'm like, that's not a favor. That's what I did this to do. So I can't. And in the end, I wouldn't anyways because it's me owing you. And technically, you're losing out double by this situation because, you know, it doesn't make sense. And she's like, well, I'm just trying to, like, work this out to help you. I'm like, but, and, like, the whole thing is you're looking at it in a capitalist point of view, and I'm trying to shed that and get away from it because it's all based on the fact that you're using money to barter still. And so, and because I have to use it right now too, and I'm like, so how do you do this? And then ended up me and Julie got in these discussions later after this moment because I'm just like, nah, I'm, you know, you're getting the favor regardless, you know. And all you had to do is say something and I do it. I'm not going to tie this to what, you know, we're working out. And then we got to talking about, because she's like, you know, you should do that. And I'm like, yeah, but I'd be lying. And I'm like, and I just can't do that. You know, like, I just, because I would do that to anyone, therefore I'm lying to her. Because if I would do that to anyone, then it's not really a favor. I'm just calling it that to, you know, get out of a bill. And I'm like, no, because I want to pay her the bill because she, that's her fee for service. And she was into barter. I'm like, we'll come up with a barter, but that's me doing labor for you, not you doing me more things. You know, that doesn't make sense. And then we got into the whole discussion of schools. And, you know, she's like, well, the interns, you know, she's like, cause she's, you know, I'm training to be a midwife. And she's like, well, I got to work for free. I'm like, and there's, you know, and I'm like, yeah. And I talk to universities, but I have an engineering students working here. But we pay the university. They give us the laborer. And this person comes to learn. It becomes a seminar course. And I'm like, that's the way interns are moving to. Free internship doesn't make sense because the person is, it's creating the elitist scenario again by you having to work for free to earn your, you know, to learn the skill when really it should be, the skill should be given to you for free as an opportunity. This is the way I was looking at it. I'm like, this, I'm, if we keep up this regime of basically making people suffer to gain, then the world will always be full of people that are just worn out and not able to get to that. And therefore, the only people that can get there are people with lots of money. And that's how we ended up with the society we've got now. And I'm like, Julie, as much as you're advocating midwifery the way it's set up, I'm like, that's just because that system's like that. But I'm like, I don't believe in it. And I, you know, we're still going to do it because that's how you're going to get your license. And I'm like, so we're going to do it. But as far as it, I don't agree with the tactic. it's an old system that adheres to money, and it's not pushing society forward. School should be free. If people take it serious or not, that's on them. That's not on us to create a scenario where, okay, you paid me money to teach you this, so now you're going to take it more serious, because we know that's not true. Otherwise, we'd have a lot more intelligent people, not book smart people, because people will go to school, take it serious, and do something with it. School doesn't do that. Right now, no. As we've talked about, the education system sucks because it's full of now people trying to facilitate the same machine. Now it's just a meat grinder. And I'm like, if it were all free, education was out there, healthcare providers, healers, all this stuff were supported by the community, education teachers supported by the community, and then everybody goes and learns whatever they can learn when they feel like learning it, society would leap forward.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, so I can't, you know, and this is kind of what I was like, oh, my God, okay, that's the discussion. Like, what does it mean? You know, like, what is this society? Where are we going to? And how will that operate? And I was thinking, like, well, here's a great start point. Because we keep going to this. Money and education, money and capitalism, business, like the barter system, the exchange system. How are we going to do this? Like, what are these small solutions to transition over? We all know, like, personally, you know, you got to take your house, and you need to stop needing money, get more to the provisions, find ways to get your provisions without finding the tool to get them. You know, like, don't look for money, look for provisions. And money may be the way to get there, but sooner or later you're going to find a way without it, and then you won't need money to do it anymore. And looking at this, and you look at now, provisions can be education. Provisions can be transportation. Provisions can be, you know, a number of things, depending on what is it, you know, provisions are necessities. And when you set a goal, the steps to the goal are the necessities to get there. It's just, what are you looking at? What is this thing you're dealing with? And you know, break it down like that. And so by attacking education and looking at it in this manner we keep going back and forth to, free education is really it. And it has to be maintained and funded by the society that uses it. So, like, you're not paying to go to school, but society supports that the school is there and the teachers are well fed, they're taken care of. They're given provisions more than they're given money. They're given homes, they're given food, they're given health care, you know? And then they don't need $80,000 to $100,000 to, you know, in tenure at a university, you know? And this is kind of what was hitting me in the last couple hours from that discussion I had to hear. And I thought maybe we could jump from that point. Like, what does it mean to you guys? Where are we going, and how do we get there?
I'm definitely for free education and all along the way. And I think that, you know, there's been in the past with colleges, the government has had programs for like pre-med and medical students. That their college would be paid for if they signed this contract to, you know, work in some marginal area for so many years after graduation, then that would mean that their education was paid for. And so that was, now that, of course, that's the government and their thing. But I see what you're talking about just on your own level, Ken, with, you know, having some interns come in and you want to pay them something or do something, but why not some kind of a contract? That would be a barter, you know.
Yeah,
teach you this.
That's a good idea. I didn't think about that. I may have to reapproach this.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, I'll pay you. You come here for education, but you're going to be here for 2 years or something. Yeah.
Right. And you're going to... whatever, you're going to do Saturday teach-ins with whoever. I mean, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that part is okay. I mean, we're not necessarily monetary, but it's a barter.
That would be the key thing.
Yeah, I'd like to chime in because this I was listening to what you're saying. What I kind of made some notes before the show, what I was kind of thinking about was we are in a transition. It's like going through a train tunnel and you're going through a mountain. And on one side of the mountain is one kind of climate. On the other side of the mountain is another side of climate. We're going from something that we knew. You know, I actually took a train journey and I had an interesting problem with clothing. Some places we were in, the train was very cold. Sometimes I had to put almost everything I had on in Chicago. And it was cold. It's like 9 degrees. And then, you know, I ended up in a place, you know, when I left on that train, I left from Sacramento, California, so it was really warm. So it's a change. It's a very significant change from one state to the other state. And the two states that I see is a scarcity-based economy, which is monetized. So we're monetized. You count things that are scarce, right? You don't count things that are abundant. So what's happening is we've had this grinding drive to monetize everything to the point we're now having, and the Nestle company wants to privatize access to water. We have, the fracking issues, taking away something that had been abundant up until now, which was water, which will be, so they're making a scarcity out of it. In other words, what you have to do is you manufacture scarcity, because it's the scarcity that makes the need to count. So then you use the little dollar abacus, you know, to count the scarcity. And the entire mindset is scarcity. And part of this, you know, scary part of that is, you know, basically there was people who benefit from the economy tanking. They benefit from industries going down. They benefit from war. You know, they benefit from destruction because it creates a scarcity and they make money from it. You know, a piece of plywood just before a hurricane is worth, in hurricane area, is worth a heck of a lot more than a piece of plywood in a real sunny day in that area. So that's the whole mindset, and the whole system is made for the scarcity, and it has ground the, you know, whole industries into the dirt. I've been dealing with people with real estate issues and their mortgages, and what has happened to the real estate industry is that homeowners are really, if they are like have a MERS loan or some of these fraudulent loan instruments that were bundled into, you know, investments, they're really, their recourse to resolve issues is just a nightmare scenario, and it's hugely widespread. So now we have the real estate industry grinding to a halt. I would say the education system is ground into a halt as well, when you have people who graduated with loans that they can't ever pay back, and they and this whole system, you know, you go to school to, quote-unquote, get a job, and that's what the job is supposed to then turn around and pay for the loan. And now you've got all these people, they're just as stuck, in a sense, as the homeowner that's got the upside-down loan or whatever. We're actually watching those systems grind to a halt. They're not going to work long-term because the solution, somebody has to lose out, and somebody is the banks, and they don't want to. Because they can go to Congress and say, hey, we bail us out. So that's kind of, to me, like, put a fork in it, it's done, you know. What we're transitioning to is revaluing things, changing our value system and changing how we look at it toward an abundance economy, toward where we value creating abundance, not scarcity. We demonetize things. We make things open source. You know, I run a Linux operating system. I never have to pay for software, ever, because I run an open source software, and I have participated as a documenter in open source projects, which means that word processor, my operating system, my graphics program, doesn't cost me anything because it's the people who use the program participate in upgrading it. One gentleman is saying, hey, we can open source a lot more than just software. It's an incredibly wonderful concept, and in fact, the Tesla car company has just open sourced their energy system that's used in their car. So they're basically giving away the farm. They're giving away, this is how we create electricity to run a car so it can run the way that a Tesla car does. So I think we're just in that transition. We're going to, the other system's done. We're going to transition to an abundant system, but that transition along the way is not a short-term thing, and it's really confusing. Like, I totally get what you're saying about how do you figure out the deal? Really, if you want to have, you know, as much integrity as you can toward your philosophy of abundance and fairness, you can't just slapdash do a deal because the tendency is to do the deal the way it used to be done. And mm-hmm. and that isn't really going to work anymore. It really, literally, energetically is falling apart the old ways.
It feels like that. Like the deals, so many people are, their lives are turning into a situation where they're forced to do this. And,
yes.
you know, it looks ugly on the way in, but positive on the way out. Like my farm, the system we have, dude, we had an investor try and steal it. Literally, we were, you know, technically, in a way, like softly crashed for a year and a half, and he couldn't
mm-hmm.
figure it out. He couldn't figure it out because it was, there was nothing to figure out. There was no secret. You got to know how to grow shit, you know? And the guy, like, he couldn't do it. And we ended up, you know, basically, we weren't even worried. It was a laugh, you know? It was like, cool, take it, dude, you know? And he's still up there trying to find money to run it, you know, in another state. And we're just watching the thing, his ship's sinking, because it takes somebody that understands hydroponics to do hydroponics. There was no secret. And we all believed in open source technology. So we kept all the, and it was one of the reasons why I had such a hard time getting investors, because there was nothing to patent. I don't believe in patents. I didn't want to do it. But we couldn't patent anything. They're like, what? And I'm like, the only thing I can patent is the automation. And honestly, there's automation systems out there that are doing exactly what we're going to do. I'm not reinventing the wheel. We're going to get that piece. And we're and they're, I'm done. Like, why would I do this just to have something to protect it? I'm like, dude, just, I want everyone to do this. There is no way I can monopolize vertical indoor farming. We already have a really good system, and there's only so many of us. We can keep expanding, but there's no way we can manage all that and that money and all that crap. There's no way. So, like, for the industry to explode, you got to let it go. It's like born free, you know. You got to put the lions back into the field. And people just, you know, we're hoarders, and we're scared of the depression still, so... You know, we're in that mindset of protect your job, protect, you know, and it's like, dude, if we just all embraced technology the same way that Native Americans and really indigenous people embraced their societal structure, the village concept, and you did it with everything, there'd be nothing to protect and no need to protect it because it's there for anyone. And, you know, like, I want to be the cobbler for the village. Cool. Be the cobbler for the village. And another guy walks up. I want to be the cobbler. Well, this guy's not paying his bills with cobblering because there's no bills to pay. Therefore, everyone could be a cobbler. It could be a cobbler village. Who cares? At that point, you only produce what's needed or you're just making a bunch of shit to sit on a shelf. But nobody loses out from your effort, because it's your time, your effort. You follow what you love, that, and you follow your passion. It's also going to destroy a few industries, which is really crazy. You think about it.
Well, that's kind of, you said applied technology. That's not a bad thing. That's just a normal life cycle. I mean, the guys that were making the buggy whips lost out when the car was invented.
Mm.
Okay, so that's,
there you go.
Because, but that's okay, because maybe they could go make something that was related to the car, you know. So it's a progression. It's a progression.
Yeah, like, didn't Angel say something last week about, oh, my God, it was really, like, God, he was, like, really on a go with
the water
reclamation stuff he's doing.
It was the water.
Yeah, no.
Right
at
the end.
That one's excellent. Yeah, that's another, like, I'm so excited for that. But the, he was talking about governmental and legalese, like the language system, like the jobs of, like, it got me thinking about this. There are people who are, like, right now, like we see, especially in technology, there are people who are experts in web search optimizations. There are people that know their way around, like, that stuff. It's an industry in itself. It's, you know, And it's like this kind of like old jobs will die off, and we get scared, and we're like, but new jobs come up. And it's just kind of one of these things where if you're not pressured to pay a mortgage, to pay a school loan, to pay, you know, like you can go with these transitions, with these evolutionary breaths, and you can exhale and inhale with it because you're not losing or gaining. If everything were open source, you've eliminated money, period, because there's nothing.
Accounting the scarcity.
Exactly.
You've eliminated. I love that you said open source.
God.
Yeah. You eliminate, demonetize it. You're eliminating the need to manufacture scarcity. I mean, people are actively figuring out, how can I make this toaster break? You know, how can I make this toaster break, 5 months earlier?
Yeah.
Because if we do that, they'll have to get another toaster. I mean,
it's the same as cell phones.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Planned obsolescence, that's what it is.
Yeah, that's a designed obsolescence, yeah. I saw that when I ran that water treatment plant for years at the mill. And it designed obsolescence, and there's also the same concept, but on job protection. There were, like, the electricians and mechanics who would not, when I walked into water treatment, they were scared they would lose their jobs because I was a machinist and a plumber and an automation engineer. You know, like I had all these skills to go in there, and they figured like I was going to basically take away their position, which there were guys who were the mechanics for water treatment. And so going in there, I had to learn all this machinery by myself because nobody would teach me. Because they all were like, I'm not teaching you what I know because then you're going to take my job. I'm like, I don't want your job. I'm doing a different job, but I got to know this so I know what to tell you. It took 6 months to build their trust. And ended up, they're brilliant, like genius guys. And I'm just, because I walked in, I had an education, all these things that like they did not like because it was a threat to them. And it's like, why would you in an industry want your employees to be that scared?
Yeah.
They end up with animosity. You know what they did? They took advantage of the union rules. They would hide and sleep in corners and take advantage of the overtime because they didn't give two shits about their company.
No.
Because that company kept them scared, threatened, and upset.
That company
didn't
give two shits about them.
They did.
Right.
And they don't, you know, and that's the problem. And so, like, you got to look at, you know, it's kind of like any relationship. If you get into a perpetual habit of fight, of defense, then you're always looking for, well, so-and-so did this, so I got to react like this. And you forget who took the first blow. You know, you just, it's gone. All it is reaction against reaction against reaction. And the only way to stop it is to cut the cord. It's in any relationship. So you look at in industries where, you want to build this relationship with the people that are generating whatever you need to keep the business alive. Well, treat them equal. And all of a sudden, you don't got to worry about a damn thing. That's something we're discovering right now at the farm. Like, I'm just looking for people that can become my clones in certain aspects of what I do. And then go, make this your baby. What do you want from this? Okay, we're going to make sure we get that to you. We're going to do our best. You're going to help me make sure you get that. If I were at the mill and it were a place where no one was scared for their job, I walk into this new job, they would be like, what do you need to know? Cool, let's go learn this. Come on, you know, let's figure this out together. And America in general is not like that on any level, in the hospitals, in education, in anything. Every industry, it's cutthroat, protect yourself at some level. And if it were open sourced, and you were not at threat to lose your job because money was not an issue, they're not looking at, like, how can we cut corners? Well, we're going to do this over here. You wouldn't need a union. If you had a company that produced a product and this company, everybody was satisfied. Everybody was happy.
And everybody that worked there were the owners.
Yes, exactly. Then you're not dealing with money. Now, this is here's the dilemma. This is where I was like, ooh, this is a good discussion is, okay, so name an industry that that's going to be an easy transition. And then how do you do it? The steel mill, how do you do it? Well, if it's owned by the workers are offered large sum of stock. Okay, well, you're still using money. Okay, great. Well, let's say money dies. Let's say the Fed collapses in 5 years. The world still needs steel. The world still needs these things. So the whole infrastructure is still trying to stay afloat. So now you got these workers, like, okay, the dollar just dropped. It's gone. Now we have, let's say, a state currency, or we went to a cryptocurrency, or we got something of that effect. And we now have all this steel that is sitting here cold and not molten because I can't pay the electric bill, and all the workers can't pay their mortgages. Everything hit, and we try and rebuild the society, like in The Postman or something, you know? Like, we're trying to rebuild these towns and these things and this stuff. How do you do it?
Well,
how do you do it?
I want to point out one thing. Pick a few things that are abundant and don't let them be made a scarcity. Water is for that kind of industry. So water is one of those things where it was originally abundancy, and there is absolutely planned efforts to make it a scarcity by, like, let's say fracking is destroying water tables, which will destroy access to water. So basically stop any activity where you have something that's already relatively abundant that some person somewhere, some entity somewhere is trying to make into a scarcity. People don't value, because we could say don't allow it. Okay, well, that's got to be grassroots awareness. That has to be, everybody has to be aware that it's stupid to allow an abundance to be made into a scarcity, and we're not going to stand for it. There are plenty of people doing wonderful work of activism in that area. More of it. You know, don't let things be made a scarcity that is abundant. So right there, you already now set the tone to at least neutral on a resource that's needful to get that steel, because you have to have water to cool it, by the way.
Well, here, let's say like terraformers, okay? You know, we kind of leaned into it. So you got a terraformer, automatically solved the fracking disturbing the water table issue, because you're dehydrating the atmosphere, which is, you can have a million terraformers, nothing is going south on that one. It is absolute gain everywhere. It's why they've
buried. Technology that Angel was talking about right at the end of the last show. Is that correct?
Could you
explain that a little? Because we got cut off on that, and I was
okay.
Really...
Imagine what they have is they've developed basically. Imagine having a super cheap, as far as components to build, very resourceable, accessible dehydrator. And this dehydrator basically runs on minimal energy, and it collects, I think he told me it was roughly one unit will do 30 gallons a day. You're pulling, when distilled means distilled is, you know, you pull all the elements out of water minus hydrogen and oxygen. It picks up all the heavy ions, heavy metals, because the water evaporates and lifts into the air. And then this thing collects it and then distributes it back to you. So anything, when water's in the air and it's in its gas form, it can't, obviously this shit's too heavy to stick to it. So that's, you know, when you distill water, if you do it, through heat, and you get it into a gas form, it's easy. You collect it by having basically a cold surface, and you want large surface area. I don't know all the components in this, but any air conditioner any dehumidifier, any, you know, any form of water line in your house, cold water line, on a humid day. Hot, humid day, what do you have? Sweaty water lines. It's that concept. It's that heat transference, because what happens is this cold pipe, heat wants to go in there. Why? Well, because cold is it's lacking heat. Heat is the movement of molecules. So as it's going through this water, the energy of that, this water is now losing its intense, high-energy gas form, and is now wanting to coalesce with itself, coagulate. So it ends up becoming a drop. That's rain. Well, and then you got this cold surface. That's where the heat's going. And it then collects on the cold surface because the heat is now dissipated. Everything coagulates. All the water is now, boom, it hit a cold surface. Heat transferred into the pipe. Surface of the pipe now has a wet drop on it. So there's a million dehydrators and things like that, you know, that they distillers. They take this, they make water gas, and then they collect it. Well, a terraformer is basically a giant dehumidifier, and you set it outside, and it's really good at attracting water from the atmosphere because it's everywhere. It's just not in high form. Well, he's basically working with some guys that developed a really awesome one that I have my eyeball on hardcore. Because
terraformers, I want to know more, too. I live in Texas. I was just
you live in a shitty area when it comes to wells.
We have towns that have to have water trucked in the summer because of the wells drop too low and they can't get water in the water system.
You want to hear something crazy? Is I've got a similar instance with where I built. I'm got my farm going in. I'm in a town. It's a Superfund site. What had occurred, It's not a Superfund site, but it's like an adjunct Superfund site. It's not fully Superfund. A Superfund site is a site where the soil is absolutely chemically damaged and the water table, and you are not allowed to develop on it in any form of where people can take in. It's poisonous. Chernobyl's a Superfund site. The entire southern lakeshore of Lake
Tacoma,
Michigan.
Washington. Yeah, part of Tacoma, Washington had an aluminum smelter, so they're actually building apartments over a Superfund site.
Wow. That's it. Like, the water table screwed. Well, here I am walked into a town. This town can't get anyone to move in. They have a shitty economy. They're tiny. And 15 years ago, I can't remember the plant, but they had a coal ash spill. And it dumps molybdenum and boron into their water table, and now the soil is riddled with radiated molybdenum and boron. So I ended up, this is where we ended up, the building we moved into. And I'm like, well, there's a pipe dream and a half for me, because that's the kind of crap I'm into more than farming. It was just a way to get there. So, and I've been big into terraforming and soil rectification and basically rejuvenating the environment, the ecosystems. And Angel, the guy that developed this terraformer, is a buddy of mine and Angel's. And I have been talking with him about helping me with this project. And his terraformer is perfect because their water table's screwed. So we go in and we basically plant sunflowers and mushrooms and get like all this stuff going that likes to absorb hemp. If Indiana will let that, right now I hear that industrial hemp's legal, so maybe I can get, you know, like a environmental permit to plant hemp all through their town. It will then absorb the molybdenum and it'll absorb the boron. So it's pulling it from the soil as the water wicks through and leaches it into the soil. You have plants that like to eat that. Sunflowers are really good for it. And
I knew about mushrooms from the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Paul Stamet out in
Paul Stamet's my hero. Yeah.
What happens with that crop then?
Well, that's the thing. Okay, so you got this crop. Well, here's the beauty of that situation. You can now turn that around. And you can then reclaim those in different industries. One of my favorites is biodiesel. So we're transitioning into electric cars. You still got burning generators. They do hydrogen. They do this. but you have all this fixed. How do you get rid of it? Well, let's go burn it off. If
wow.
you can extract enough plant material, I haven't, this is just ideas right now I'm dealing with a chemist on who developed a really awesome biobutanol. I'm trying to help him get out there too. And if they, what basically a biobutanol can burn in any engine, not just diesel, and it has such a low freeze point, it'll last through heavy winters. So, and it's
wow.
very inert, so like it's not going to like explode. It's like motor oil. And so we've been talking, and we're talking about is can we take these plants and basically extract the oil and carry the metals and the ions with it? And if you could do that, then you compost out the last of the material, or you can burn it or whatever, and then take that collection of ash, find ways to not just store it, but like use it, put it in bricks, hemp bricks or something, use it in a building where it's not going to leach out, it reform itself, bond to something else, and then in the oil, hopefully you have these same metals and you start burning them off, because you can decompose them. You can deactivate ions.
Yeah.
It's hard. But that's what we're looking at. How do we do this? Now, if you got all these radiated things, how do we basically make them inert? And you're now given a catalyst, a storage device that is stored energy, too. So then so that's where we're kind of like, okay, the mushrooms are the hard one. Because there isn't a lot you can do with a mushroom right now once you gathered all that, but there are fungus out there that actually degrade ions. So they will take...
Yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah, so, like, that's the thing, is we're looking at these different things, and this guy who developed the terraformer is, like, a world-renowned permaculturist, and he's big
yeah.
into phytorectification, which is basically rectifying soil using plants, and mushrooms and fungus and stuff, you know, living organisms. So while looking at all this, this is what I walked into at this place, and we got this terraformer, and I'm like, oh, my God, like, we could fix this town, and it will only, for the investors, like, I'm looking at, like, for me, this is what I want to do. But I got to sell this to these billionaires. How are they going to make this a financial gain for them? Well, we're going to expand like mad, because people will ask us to come to their towns. Businesses will want us because the PR you developed by saving this town's soil and bringing back a good water table. I'm like, that's how I sold it. And the funny thing is, it's like using your evil powers for good. Like, it is the truth. It wasn't a sale. And they were like, oh. And I'm like, it's all PR for you guys. It doesn't cost much. You can expand this like mad because everyone's going to be like, wow, you guys are great guys. And for them, that's better than billboards and, you know, ad space. So it looks good. And then for us, as the individuals who are all about community and environment, it's like there is an absolute laboratory and R&D situation, and we have the funding behind it that it's not a grant sponge. It's a complete circle. It's a total, the financial, you know, the machine right there is a complete ecosystem. It's sustainable.
Yeah.
So,
it's a self-reinforcing organism, mechanism. It's
it was bizarre when this
hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It hit us, and we're just like, oh, my God, that's crazy. And it's everything I wanted out of this. So, anyways, that was how the whole terraformer thing came into play, and that's, like, some of the uses. Like, and also the terraformer, I was looking into developing a small-scale one for the farm because we recycle every bit of water in that place. The only water that leaves the building, because it's zero waste, it goes from inside the plants. It leaves with the plants. Everything else, it just keeps going back and back and back through. And a terraformer will even gather the humidity in the room because you don't want it too humid. So you gauge it to pick up all that water, and then you just throw it back in the system. And we were looking at mini ones. And so, oh, it's just been really interesting, like, coming into this. So here we go. Back on the original conversation, say we solve the water problem. Great. But that's not what we all live and thrive on. That's one. Say we solve the food problem, too, because maybe I might be part of that. Maybe what we developed might integrate into something similar. So let's say all the vital needs to keep a body from dying have occurred. And healthy food means, you know, you're living healthier, which means you probably don't need antibiotics and things. I haven't done them in 15, 20 years now. So I know diet helps. So let's say we've created a system where the money we have to earn to put into staying alive is negated. Well, you know, for my family, that's like $1,200 a month. So that's a big, big dip for me. That's great. But now you still got, I'm in a country where it costs money to rest my head on this plot of land.
Yeah.
So you have property tax. Property tax, let's say the Fed dies. That negates, that falls out. States become their own government. States still need to generate, they need to generate their own money. Are we sustaining enough in that? Maybe. So let's say we covered that. So now your land is free, or I'd rather see it like I think we all agree. Everything's open source, kind of like the way the Native Americans did it. More communal. You don't own land, but you're also not going to get kicked off. You can build a house somewhere. The only property you have is just that. And you're like, I adhere to the rules of this place. Therefore, you know, you leave me alone, I leave you alone. This is what we do. And say we develop a nice societal system that does that. Okay, great. And say everybody's given a home, too. Okay, great. But now you've got all the components needed to make these terraformers. You've got all the components needed to push the paperwork to keep your home from being taken from you. You've got all the components needed to grow that food, the vinyls, the plastics, all these things, they come from somewhere. That industry needs to be supported. If we eradicate money and we go full barter, how do I buy the power, or even better, how do I buy the components to produce the power? Let's say we're at that point too. To keep the farm alive so that I can give free food to people. So where, you know, like this is what I was seeing in all our discussions was we talk about the obvious, but you know, like we're all really aware of how industries and businesses work, especially in our own. We're very comfortable with what we know. So when your computer breaks?
We're not having major corporations own things anymore. So it's okay, this group over here, they're making windows. And I'm thinking about this because some people in Chicago have taken over a plant and are running it. I mean, they own it now, the workers. And in Cleveland, you know, there's a lot of worker-owned building businesses. So instead of, though, then working for a profit, it's like, we're making windows over here. So you need a window, you come get it. And I need some food, I'm coming to your farm.
Okay, so here's that. You're right on the money. Like, I've been talking we never brought Gabe in on this, but me and Gabe, buddy of mine, you guys kind of know of him, but we talk about this constantly. And here's the thing. It's because the window is, if well made, is a single-time necessity. Food is a constant. Now, if people are growing their own food, let's assume everyone's growing their own food. So I'm only supplying food for, say, hospitals or schools or something, you know. Say, or even the town's doing it, and my system's now in the town. Like, see, like, you start to even level out, and it's just all trade here and there. How do we get from, because I think, Ruthann, you're on it. That is it, is if everybody is a village in action on every component, it will operate. You know, like you could see the end point makes a lot of sense. It's that utopian, everything's accessible, but who's running those things and how do we go from, like, you need right now, how many steel components? Oh, we'll go back to the steel one because that's a really messed up industry. That one, it's not as easy to do what we're saying. So let's do that one. Let's, like, attack this. How many steel components right now, just looking in the room you're sitting in, how much steel is in that room? Like, what would you have? You got the screws or nails
from so
and
many
construction.
This is where, even though it's for profit, where Mondragon in Spain has just set us so many wonderful examples. And
okay,
those companies are for profit, but you know they deal with other of their own. I mean, there's what, like 300,000 people working in these companies, and they deal with their own kinds of people who are in this big collective, but they also they deal with the outside too, because they are still not for, I mean, they still are a for-profit company. But you have to, yes, be able to get all these, like you're saying, you've got to get the screws, you've got to get the glass from somewhere, you've got to get the wood from someplace, the steel. It's not going to happen overnight.
But how do you start? Because, see, this is the argument that keeps this perpetuated. Nobody knows how to start, and
well,
then nobody knows how to make the next step.
Well, this country,
like, I think
has
you
a
hit
lot of collectives. They have a lot of worker-owned businesses. So that's,
I think that's it. It is a good start. So let's say every company now is worker-owned. Okay, let's say we succeeded.
Well, it's incremental. The whole transition is incremental. It has to be kind of
sure.
a plan or a decision or a resource
okay.
at a time. And it also has to be kind of a growing value system of average person to say, like, you know, I was aware of the World War II generation that had their victory garden. I mean, people knew why
yeah.
they had to do that, is because there was a general awareness that there was going to be the rationing and the food shortages. They needed to be responsible for their food needs, and that's such an awareness thing. We were actually out in our front yard trying to figure out some food value for our landscaping that still looked like landscaping, so because of code enforcement here in the city is pretty rigid. So we have to have a sort of an edible landscape look to the front yard. We have a full-on garden in the back, but if we're going to get any food value in the front, we have to have sort of an edible landscape plan or whatever. I came from Olympia, where they were beginning to take some of the Capitol grounds lawns and turning them into foods, and there was food not lawns movement kind of out there to start bringing up the awareness that, and then the other thing, the food value of the food in the grocery store is dropping precipitously, being GMO and whatnot. It's an incremental decision process for everyone. Everyone needs to start making, a change to demonetize some aspect of their life, to take responsibility for that they're going to get food, not just depend on the grocery store as the only option.
So
it really is that value system of valuing an abundance, valuing the fact that you can stick some seeds in the ground and they'll come up. You know, that's an amazing thing. You know, the GMO thing is so anti-life because you make a suicide seed that doesn't come up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically becoming really aghast and really horrified by anything that's anti-life or scarcity-based, and embracing and rewarding and celebrating and participating in anything that's permaculture or abundant.
We can't depend on the natural
and education system to be the one to tell us that, because they basically educating people to do the old system. So it's really the education
system. Out of school. Get real. I mean, we can't depend on, I mean, so that's totally something different. But about done again.
Oh, my God.
Like this.
God, that was so fast.
You want to continue with the same topic next time?
Oh, yeah. I don't even think we scratched the scab yet.
I'd love to.
Yeah,
okay.
Awesome.
See if Brett wants to come in next time. And why don't you, I thought that Angel might, I saw he was online earlier. But, we'll get other voices in here, hopefully.
Sweet, No, we'll get more. Great. I am so happy because there's, like, so much to tackle here.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right. I'll see you guys next week.
Ready?
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.